sunshine meets on Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8.
A very good evening. Hope you're well this Sunday night. You're listening to Sunshine 106.8. I'm Andrea Hayes, and this is Sunshine Meets. Now, my guest tonight has won many high-profile awards in recognition for his lifetime work, working with many people homeless or in crisis. He also won Freeman of the City of Dublin in 2014. And I think it's fair to say he is a household name, as is his trust that he founded. Through a lot of hard work, simple living and social campaigning, he's dedicated his life and his vocation to helping those in crisis of all ages. Through his tireless work with the homeless and helping many people with addiction issues and indeed their family. I think you all know who we're meeting, but Sunshine Meets Jesuit priest, Father Peter McFerry. It's a pleasure to have you in the studio.
Thank you very much, Andrea.
Well, we're going to start, as we always do, Peter, in the early younger years of Peter. You're a native of Newry. Can you tell me a little bit about growing up and your younger years?
Well, I had a very happy childhood. Newry was a small town. My father was a doctor in Newry, so we lived a very financially comfortable lifestyle. My father, a doctor in a small town, had sort of social status, so probably would have described myself as upper middle class, even growing up in Newry. It was a very depressed town, actually, because unemployment was very high and Newry was one of the unemployment black spots. It was known as Bachelor's Paradise because all the males, when they left school, went off somewhere else to work, and there were about 10 girls for every male who remained behind. So, but it was a happy time. I went to the local Christian Brothers school in the primary. Then my father, who had been at a Jesuit boarding school in Clongowes himself, sent me and my other brothers to Clongowes. So my second level schooling was with the Jesuits down here. So it was a happy period. Yes.
And can you speak to me a little bit about your mother? Did she have a huge influence on you and your brothers?
Both my mother and my father. My father was a doctor, as I say, in the days before you had a practice. So he was on his own. He had his patients. He didn't have, in the early years anyway, he didn't have a partner who could sort of take every second weekend and let him free. So I would often hear the phone going in the house at night time at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. My father would get up, get out and go to his patients. And I learnt later that he often went out to other doctor's patients as well because they weren't available. But I never heard a complaint from him. So I think I got a sense of service from my father. My mother was a Welsh Protestant who converted to Catholicism to marry my father, because in those days, if my father, a Catholic, had married a Protestant, he would have been doomed to go to hell for all eternity. So to avoid that fate, my mother converted to Catholicism and, like many converts, became more Catholic than the Catholics themselves. So it was a family rosary every evening, couldn't miss it, no excuses, Mass every Sunday. So I think I got my faith from my mother and my sense of service from my father. And when I decided what I was going to do with my life, I wanted to be of service. And becoming a priest was a way of combining that sense of faith with a sense of service. And since I was in a Jesuit school, I sort of drifted into the Jesuits. but I've never looked back. They're great.
And in terms of your brothers, your brothers also had a very strong sense of service, and all of them went into a similar line to your father.
Yeah, they all became, we're a real doctor's family. My father was a doctor. My mother had been a nurse before she married and became a full-time housewife. My two brothers became doctors. My uncle, who also worked in Newry, was a doctor. His three children became doctors. So I swore I wasn't going to become a doctor. So it was a very medical family. My two brothers are doctors. They both went to England eventually, and they've worked in England all their lives. So contact with them is a little bit sporadic, but yeah, that was... And my sister is a full-time housewife in Newry, so I still go up to her every so often. We have a meal together, and but I only see my brothers when maybe once every 5 years or something. They'll come back to Ireland just to for a brief holiday.
As many families, that happens to many families. Maybe you're a doctor of the heart because of your decision of what you did. Do you remember the conversation as a young teenager talking to your parents about your decision to go into the Jesuits?
Yeah, I remember my parents, they were very open about it. The attitude was, if that's what you want to do, go and do it and see how it works out. So they certainly weren't pushing me to do it. No, absolutely not. I'd say they would have perhaps preferred me to have a nice, secure, well-paid job. But no, they were supportive in the sense, if that's what you want to do, we'll support you. So yeah, they did, and right through the noviceship and that, they were very supportive. Yes. Yeah.
So you were in UCD and ordained in the mid 70s. Was it 1975?
1975, I got ordained. Yes, I had I'd done a degree in chemistry in UCD. Then I had done philosophy and theology with the Jesuits. Then I got ordained in 1975, but the year before 1975, three of us, including myself, moved into the inner city, and that was the turning point for me. That was the moment in which my life took a turn. I joined the Jesuits. Originally, I wanted to go to Zambia on the missions. I haven't got there yet, but I'm living in Ballymun, which is beside the airport, so I'm sort of moving in that direction. But so when that wasn't going to happen, I decided I wanted to be a teacher, like many Jesuits were teaching. And then that was always my aim, studying as I was going through the Jesuits. I was going to end up teaching in some second or third level institution. But then when I went to the inner city, the life just turned around completely. I left my heart in the inner city. I loved the work, and I decided, yes, teaching isn't going to be my life.
Because you did a small spell of teaching quite close to the inner city.
I did. I taught Belvedere College for 2 years, taught science and maths. I enjoyed the teaching. But looking back on it now, I am glad I didn't spend my life teaching. Because when I left teaching, somebody else took over and probably did it much better than I could do it. So I feel if you're going to take vows of poverty, chastity and obedience, you may as well do something that the vows allow you to do that wouldn't get done if you weren't there. So teaching, I was easily replaced. So I wanted to perhaps do something that wouldn't get done if I didn't do it. And so when I went to the inner city of Dublin, that became very clear that working there was something that, if we didn't do it, it was there was going to be a gap there in services for young people in the inner city.
And just paint a picture of what it was like in the inner city, 1974, and obviously a very different place from where you were brought up and what you were used to.
Yeah, it was terrible and it was great at the same time. It was terrible in the sense that the housing was awful. There were often 8 families living in one house. In some of the houses, there was one outside toilet for the 8 families. There was no soundproofing between flats, so you could hear every word that was spoken in the flat above you or below you. There was only an open fire in the sitting room. There was no other form of heating. And the place was crawling with rats, and the rats were the size of little kittens, and immune from every poison that had ever been invented. So the housing was really appalling. It was appalling. Many of the young people growing up in the inner city knew they had no hope of getting a job. If your address was the inner city, you had no hope of getting a job. So they were leaving school early. They were leaving school at the age of 12, many of them. They were hanging around the streets all day long. Their parents, most of them were unemployed, couldn't give them any money. So what were they doing? They were doing a little bit of robbing. And by the time they got to 16 and 17, robbing was a career for some of them. And they were going to jail. That was the issue. But what was great about it was people had themselves. There was a great sense of community there. You know, and there was a moral code that you didn't rob your own. So people felt safe there, that they weren't going to be robbed. Now, that began to break down in the 70s, in the late 70s. And particularly when drugs then came in the 80s. That moral code broke down completely. But the conditions were horrific. And what astounded me most was not just the conditions that people lived in, but the fact I'd been living in Dublin for the last 10 or 12 years, and I had no idea that people lived in these horrific conditions. And I had passed Summerhill on my bike or walking and Sean McDermott Street. I had passed many times, but I had no idea what the reality of life behind those walls was like for people who are living there. And that stayed with me. And so I realised, you know, I'm working with homeless people. Many people have no idea what it's like to be homeless. They don't know anybody who's homeless. So I can understand how the issue of homelessness isn't a big issue for a lot of people, because conditions in Summerhill and Sean McDermott Street weren't a big issue for me until I actually went there and discovered for myself what they were like. So it's our ignorance of the situation that many people find themselves in today in Ireland that I think we need to change. And so I'd see it as some of my job now as raising awareness about issues like homelessness, drug addiction, and so forth, so that people have a better understanding of it. And having a better understanding of it, you can begin to change attitudes and therefore to change policies.
And you know what? That just leaves us beautifully into our first choice of music. You asked me to choose a Bob Dylan song, and it is "The Times They Are a Changing." Sunshine is meeting Peter McVerry. Enjoy.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changing. Come writers and critics who prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin, and there's no telling who that it's naming. For the loser now will be later to win. For the times, they are a-changing. Senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't lock up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. The battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls. For the times, they are a-changing. The mothers and fathers throughout the land.
A very good evening. You're so welcome back. You're listening to Sunshine 106.8. Hope you're having a nice Sunday evening wherever you're tuned in. I'm Andrea Hayes. And as you've probably been listening, my guest tonight has won many awards for his lifetime work with people in crisis. He set up a trust in his name, Sunshine Meets Jesuit Priest Father Peter McVerry. Peter, we're talking about you in the inner city, the late 70s, and that was actually where you first set up your first hostel. But you might explain the story and a particular boy that had a huge impact on your life.
Yeah, when we went into the inner city first, the issue that became very clear to us was young people leaving school early and setting out on a path of crime. So we opened a youth club in the area originally. We opened a craft centre. They could make lovely crafts and sell them, make a few bob legally. And we were able to employ some of the kids making the crafts, and we'd sell them to the shops in town to pay their wages. We did that for a couple of years, and then I came across a kid sleeping on the street, 9 years of age. So we said, look, we have a youth club for these young people. We have a craft centre. We have employment schemes. So why don't we get a house and open a little hostel? So we did. So we got a house and we opened a little hostel for six boys up to the age of 16. Why boys? There were no girls on the streets back in the 1970s. That only came later. So we opened a hostel for six boys. I thought no more of it. It was just another service for the young people of the inner city. But I ran that for a couple of years, and then the young people were leaving that at 16, 16 and a half, and they were going back onto the streets. So we said, look, what's the point in running a hostel for young people up to 16 if they're just going to go back on the streets? So I had moved to Ballymun then. They had demolished the whole inner city in 1980. All the old tenement flats were demolished in 1980, and including the flat we were living in. So everybody was relocated, and we relocated to Ballymun. So I was living in Ballymun, and I asked Dublin City Council for a flat to use as a hostel for the over-16s. And to my surprise and to their regret ever since, they gave it to me. So now we had a hostel for the over-16s. And then the numbers grew and grew and grew. And we eventually had often 15, 16 young people sleeping in a three-bedroom flat. So we had to get another house in town to take the overflow. Then the Child Care Act came in 1991. We had to separate out the under 18s from the over 18s, child protection and all that. So we had to get another house. And then the drug problem hit Dublin, and we had 14, 15 year olds coming to us injecting heroin. So we had to open a detox centre. Then what do young homeless people do when they've come off drugs? Do they go back onto the streets? In which case they've wasted their time coming off drugs because they're not going to stay off drugs. So we had to open a drug free hostel, where they could live for another 6 months after becoming drug-free. And then the problem arose, where do they go after the 6 months? So we started buying a few apartments so that they could go and live in an apartment for another 12 months after finishing the drug-free house. So one thing just led to another. There was no plan. We never drew up plans or anything like that. We just went from year to year. What's the next need? Let's try and meet that need. And when you meet that need, another need opens up and you try and meet that need. So we just went. I never planned more than a year ahead. I said, well, I'll spend the next year doing this and then we'll see what happens. And then at the end of the year, you said, well, we'll spend the next year doing this, see what happens. So we just went from year to year. And so from that 9-year-old kid sleeping on the street, we now have 25 hostels with almost 1,000 people every night staying in the hostels. We have 300 apartments where we can give a homeless person the key of the door and say, this is yours for the rest of your life. You never, ever have to be homeless again. And we have two drug treatment centres and we have a drop-in centre. And that all came from one 9-year-old kid sleeping on the street. And I'd have to say about 12, 13 years ago, we wanted to make this organisation independent of me, so that if anything happened to me, if I had a heart attack or a bus hit me, the organisation would continue. Because up to that, I was everything. I was the CEO. I did all the finances. I was the one who changed the light bulbs. I did everything. And if at that stage I had died, the whole thing would have collapsed. So we decided it had to become independent of me. So we headhunted a CEO, Pat Doyle, and he took in an administration team, and it has really taken off since then. Pat is great at producing plans, and the whole trust has expanded enormously under his watch, in a way that I couldn't do. I couldn't spend my time drawing up 5-year plans or 3-year plans or doing up policies and procedures. That would bore me to tears. What I want to do is just work directly face to face with homeless people. So it was a very good move, actually, looking back on it. It was difficult because I was losing control. And when you've been in charge and you've set up something, you don't like losing control. But I did, and I handed it over to Pat. I said, I'm not going to interfere. You make the decisions. If I don't agree with any decisions, I'll keep quiet. You're in charge now. And it was the best thing I've ever done, because it's now independent of me. If I die in the morning, it'll carry on, no problem. And Pat has had the skills to make the trust a much bigger and a more efficient and effective organisation than I was ever able to do.
And isn't it incredible to think, we're talking about the late 70s, early 80s, when a young boy, 9, sleeping on the street, changed the path of your life, and really then the trust became something that has changed thousands and thousands of boys, men, women, and now families' lives, because the work that you began doing has changed over the years. What is the biggest change you've seen?
When we started, the big problem was children under 18 who were homeless, who had left home. And the attitude then was, amongst the authorities, was that the best place for every child to grow up is in their own home. Now we know it's the worst place for some children. But in those days, if a child kept running away from home, the attitude was, call the guards, bring him back home. So when we set up our first hostel for boys up to the age of 16, nobody wanted to know. And the health board told me out front, they said, look, we don't agree with this. We don't support this. We don't see the need for this. If these young people keep running away from home, sure, there are detention schools we can send them to. That was the attitude.
And what was it in the homes that you discovered that was going on that people weren't aware of or people weren't acknowledging? Because the boys were being mistreated, obviously, at home.
They were. There was a lot of abuse. But nobody talked about it in those days. So you never actually discovered in many cases why a young person was leaving home. There was also be a lot of alcoholism amongst parents. And so there'd be rows at night. Typical example would be a young person or a number of young people, because sometimes every young person in the family ended up in our hostels. A typical case would be parents, both of them alcoholics, out in the pub every night, no electricity in the house, very little food in the house. The parents would come back at 1 o'clock in the morning drunk, and two or three nights a week might have an almighty row, which would go on for a couple of hours. And everybody was awake. The kids were wide awake. So sometimes the kids just said, I've had enough of this. I don't want this every night, and would leave home. But very often they didn't talk about it. But obviously, if you keep running away from home, there's a serious problem there.
And you kind of saw that, brought these young boys in, and then it continued on until their adult life. And then you were seeing kind of girls and families homeless.
That only happened in the last few years. I mean, what is really appalling is, in 2012, it's only 6 years ago, there was no such thing as homeless families. Didn't exist. You had one or two families a week who might lose their home because of alcoholism, not paying the rent, but they were easily rehoused by the local authority somewhere else. Some were less favourably, but they were rehoused. It's only in the last few years that the problem of homeless families has emerged. And today we have the biggest crisis now today is homeless families. Homeless, single homeless people, right, you can get a house and you can put them into a bed in a hostel, but you can't do that with families. So it's become a real crisis. And the biggest category now of homeless people is the 0-4 age group. Young children living with their parents who are homeless. So it's a catastrophe, and those children are being damaged. Every day they stay in homeless situations is damaging them. They are stressed out. Their parents are stressed out. Because the parents are stressed out, it's difficult to give the children the sort of emotional warmth and the hugs and all that you children need. children are being damaged emotionally, they're being damaged psychologically by the stress. It's creating mental health problems amongst the children and the parents. And they're being damaged educationally, because you can't go to school and focus and concentrate and work hard if all the time you're wondering, will I have anywhere to sleep tonight? Or, you know, so it's and they're being damaged physically as well, because in the hotel bedrooms or the bed and breakfast where they're accommodated, there's no cooking facility. So all your food has to be bought from a takeaway, which is extremely, shall we say, not very nutritious. So they and some of these children are in that situation for 2 years or even longer. So we are building up huge problems amongst that cohort of young people. Now, young people are very resilient. Many of them will get over it, but some won't.
Well, we're going to continue on talking about that. We're going to take a little bit of music again. And Peter said he likes Simon and Garfunkel. So I've chosen this very, I think it's quite fitting, Bridge Over Troubled Water. Sunshine meets Peter McFerry.
See how they
Sunshine Meets on Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8.
You're very welcome back. If you're just tuned in this Sunday night, you're listening to Sunshine 106.8. It's Sunshine Meets, and I'm Andrea Hayes, and we've been chatting to a man who's really been so active in helping the homeless here in Ireland since the 70s, 80s, 90s and to the present day. He's won many, many awards, and we're going to talk a little bit about that. It is, of course, Father Peter McFerry. Now, Peter, people forget that you are a priest still in active ministry because you do so much work, but you're still working every day, or at least, you know, you say Mass, I think, once a week. Is that true?
Well, I say Mass every Sunday in Wheatfield Prison, which I enjoy doing, and it's a great contact point. Now, I also say Mass in Gardiner Street Church, maybe two times a week, and I'll say Mass where other groups or organisations invite me to say Mass. So I'd say on average I say Mass probably 3-4 times a week.
So you are an active priest.
Very active. I do a lot of baptisms. I do very few marriages. And unfortunately, I do far too many funerals. Yes.
Which is the sad part of it. And one of the things we were just talking about there during the song was that you've won so many awards. I mean, in 2014, you won the Freedom of Dublin City. You were the 77th person to win that award. And, you know, you've a Lifetime Achievement Award. The list of awards is endless. You were the Person of the Year, ESB's Person of the Year. And I asked him, was there any particular award that you were most proud of? And you said you won the Entrepreneurial Award, the Business Award. Why was that one a little bit interesting for you?
Well, it was interesting in an ironic sort of way, because at the award ceremony I was asked to say a few words, and I said, you know, there were a whole lot of other business, young business people who had set up businesses, and they were getting awards for entrepreneurship. And I was saying, look, everybody else here is, their objective is to expand their business and grow it. My objective is to go out of business and close down the trust, because homelessness is solved and we are no longer needed. So that was, it was tongue in cheek, but I enjoyed saying it.
But it is actually what the focus is to end homelessness. Your objective has been very clear from the start.
Yeah, according to the International Monetary Fund, we are the third or fourth wealthiest country in the world. We have the fastest growing economy in the EU. And yet we have record numbers of homeless people every single month that comes along. It's absolutely scandalous. There should be no homelessness in Ireland. We have the resources, we have the wealth. This should not be.
And you mentioned that families are the biggest crisis at the moment that we face, particularly young children. And even the thoughts of that, if somebody's driving in their car, listening at home, just imagine that. Maybe you're comfortable wherever you're listening in, to think that a family tonight, not just one, not just two, but many families tonight perhaps are walking the streets not knowing where they're going to put their children to sleep tonight.
That's right. Currently, we have about 1,700 families who are homeless. But when you consider the number of families who became homeless and were subsequently housed by Dublin City Council, maybe after 6 months, 12 months, 24 months, we're talking of thousands of families who have experienced the trauma of being homeless, and thousands of children who have experienced that trauma. It's horrendous. And as I say, it's a recent phenomenon. And the reason for it happening today is precisely because of the housing crisis. Rents have gone through the roof. People can't afford to often to pay the rents that are being demanded, and the private rented sector simply cannot cope with the demand. So if you go to look for a house or an apartment to rent, you'll have 40 people outside waiting to view it. So one of the features of today's homelessness, unlike in the past, one of the features of today's homelessness is a sense of hopelessness. People don't know when this nightmare is going to end. Will it end next week, next month, or even next year? Single homeless people will go around the hostel circuit for year after year after year because there is so little accommodation, local authority accommodation for single people available. Families could spend up to 2 years in hotel bedrooms. They don't know when this is going to end. That's one of the worst parts of homelessness. You could tolerate it if you could see an end date. Even if the end date was several months down the road, you could tolerate it knowing it was coming to an end. But there's just this infinite stretch ahead of you and you have no idea when this is going to end. There's a fantastic film called Rosie, made by Roddy Doyle. And it describes the life in a few days of a homeless family. And it's absolutely horrendous. I would encourage everybody to see it, to get some understanding of what it's like to be homeless with your children. When I first saw Rosie, I've seen it twice. The first time I saw Rosie, I thought it was a documentary I was watching. It was so well done and so accurate to the experience of homeless people. So, and it will be shown on RT sometime because RT part funded it. But and the family in Rosie were a lucky family. They had a car and they had a job. Many homeless families don't have either of those. So at least they had a car to pile all their belongings into. And on the one night that the film portrayed them not being able to get a hotel bedroom, at least they were able to sleep in the car out of the rain. Many families don't even have that level of, I won't say comfort, but that level of backup.
It's just astonishing to think somebody with a job and a car is home with their children. So Rosie, a movie that I'm sure we'll all see on television, but Roddy Doyle, I would encourage you to look at it. For you, is there any solution? You've been seeing this problem growing exponentially since the mid-70s. Is there a solution? How can we all be part of the solution?
I think there is a solution, but I think we have two problems now. We have the problem of housing those who are currently homeless and on the social housing waiting list. But there's an even more urgent problem, and that's preventing more and more people becoming homeless. Because what's happening today is that more people and more families are presenting as homeless than are able to exit homelessness, either into local authority housing or private rented. And so the numbers keep going up. How do we house the people who are homeless today? We've got to go back to building social housing. You know, in 1975, this country built 8,500 council houses. In 1985, and we had a recession in the 80s, so we weren't flush with money, we built 6,900 council houses. In 2015, this country built 75 council houses. That's the problem. There aren't any council houses. There's a dire shortage of council houses. Now, they have increased it. There were about 2,000 built last year. But we need to be building council houses in the tens of thousands if we're going to address this problem. Of course, government don't want to do that. And we, the public, are partly responsible because if the local authority decides to build 200 or 300 council houses down the road, everybody's going to be up in arms and protest. So I think we all have to accept some responsibility for the continuation of homelessness, particularly homeless families. The other thing, though, is every street you go down, you see empty houses and empty apartments over shops that are boarded up. The government have given a grant to the owners to bring them back into use, but only a couple of hundred owners have availed of that grant. I would be saying to government, it is obscene to have a house lying empty in the middle of a housing crisis. If the owner cannot or will not bring it back into use, then compulsorily purchase it. Government will say, but that's very expensive. You go down the legal route, all the reasons why you can't do that. And what I say is they're proposing a ring road around Galway. And to build a ring road, they're going to have to compulsorily purchase 41 lived-in houses. Now, if you can do that for lived-in houses, why can't you compulsorily purchase empty houses in order to house homeless families? So that would be my solution for housing those who are currently waiting to be housed. The other problem, how do you prevent people? The majority of people becoming newly homeless today are coming from the private rented sector. Either the rents have gone through the roof, or more likely, the landlord says they're selling the house. I would make it illegal for 3 years for landlords or banks to evict people into homelessness. Just 3 years. I mean, right, that's not going to destroy any landlord's life. It may be an inconvenience for some landlords, but given the crisis we're in, the alternative is trauma being experienced by thousands of families. So I would say just for 3 years, you may not evict people into homelessness. If you want to sell the house, you either wait 3 years or you sell the house with the tenants in C2. And the other thing, and really this is what is most frightening, we now have a homeless crisis. In 2 years' time, we could have a homeless catastrophe, because there are about 40,000 mortgages in arrears of more than 2 years. 28,000 of those are owner-occupied. The other 12,000, 13,000 are landlords' mortgages that have fallen into arrears. The European Central Bank is putting huge pressure on the Irish banks to get rid of those, and they've given them 2 or 3 years to do that. And the Central Bank in Ireland have estimated that at least half of those are going to be repossessed. Now, if those are repossessed, if the government does not introduce different policies, we will face a homeless catastrophe that this country will not be able to cope with. The way to address it is there is a mortgage to rent scheme, where if your mortgage is unpayable, either a housing association or the local authority buys your house and you remain in the house as a tenant instead of as an owner. Now, that scheme exists but is very restricted and is not being pushed very hard by the Department of Housing. I would argue that that scheme should be expanded to include almost all mortgages in arrears of more than 2 years. Mm-hmm. And that it should be obligatory on the banks, because the banks don't like it either, some of them.
Well, I have to say, Peter, unfortunately we have to wrap up for music. But you've given, if we could have Peter McFerry in government, I think it would be a very different landscape. I know you have a lovely little dog, and I want to give mention to your dog. What's her name?
Her name is Tiny.
Because a lot of people see Peter going around with Tiny. She's not with us in the studio. It has been my pleasure. Sunshine has just met Father Peter McFerry, and we're going to end on a lovely song. It's James Taylor, and it's You've Got a Friend. Thank you so much.
When you're down and troubled and you need a helping hand, and nothing, oh, nothing is going right, close your eyes and think of me, and soon I will be to brighten up even your darkest night. You just call up my name, and you know wherever I am, I'll come running, oh yeah, baby, to see you again. Spring, summer, or fall, all you got to do is call, and I'll be there. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You've got a friend. If the sky above you should turn dark and full of clouds, and that old north wind should begin to blow, keep your head together and call my name out loud. knocking upon your door. You just call up my name, and you know wherever I am, I'll come running. Oh, yes, I will see you again. Spring, summer, or fall, yeah. All you got to do is call, and I'll be there, yeah, yeah, yeah. Hey, ain't it good to know that you've got a friend when people can be so cold? They'll hurt you and desert you. Well, they'll take your soul if you let them. Oh, yeah, but don't you let them. You just call out my name, and you know wherever I am, I'll come running to see you again. Oh, baby, winter, spring, summer, or fall. Hey, now all you've got to do is call. Lord, I'll be there, yes, I will. You've got a friend. You've got a friend, yeah. Ain't it good to know you've got a friend? Ain't it good to know you've got a friend? Oh, yeah.